You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Wisconsin's largest law enforcement group has some new recommendations to improve policing in the state. We take a look at their blueprint for change reforms coming up. Now, since the political party conventions began in 1831, the basic format has gone pretty much unchanged. Then, as we've heard so many times this year, cue the coronavirus. Normally, we'd have seen bashes in filled-to-capacity venues. Instead, people delivered speeches in empty rooms, some things were pre-recorded, and there wasn't a lot of room for spontaneity. Plus, the host cities of Milwaukee and Charlotte missed out on major economic opportunities. But the virtual setup had its advantages, too, including being safer, more controlled, and shorter. So which way is better? Laura Brown is an associate professor and the director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. She's also the author of multiple books, including Amateur Hour, Presidential Character, and The Question of Leadership, which came out last month. She's here to help us answer that question. Laura, nice to have you back on the show.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to be with you today.
How well do you think the Democrats and Republicans adapted to this more virtual approach to their conventions?
Well, I think the Democrats did a better job, but part of that was because they had more time to plan and think about, conceptualize sort of the entire virtual convention. The Republicans were really kind of left flat-footed because the president wanted originally to continue his convention in Charlotte, and then he wanted to go to Jacksonville for speeches. And because of those switches in the plans, they were left with trying to make the best of a bad situation, which then meant that the Republicans decided they were going to use a lot of sites and locations in and around Washington, D.C., which certainly brought up ethical concerns to many who were watching.
So overall, before we kind of dig into each, would you consider this year's conventions a success?
Well, I think they were successful in some ways. I mean, I do think that when you look at national party conventions, they had mostly been for the participants who traveled to those host cities and took part as delegates or as activists engaged in kind of the hoopla and the festivities that were around the conventions. I don't think that in the modern era, since these conventions have been largely uncontested, not very exciting for television audiences, that they really have brought people together across the country in a way that they were originally intended to. And this is where I think there were and was a real advantage to the grassroots engagement that people could have, even if it was just taping a video.
Let's take a listen now to Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett during the Democratic National Convention.
It was the first time a major political party chose Wisconsin to hold its convention. But these are not conventional times. And as a result, as we all know, this is not a conventional convention. And as much as we would have loved to host you in person, I am proud that the Democratic Party and the city of Milwaukee have made the health of our residents our number one priority.
Laura, do you think having a more scaled back convention in the name of safety registered with voters?
Well, I think it's certainly registered in terms of there was a public effort put forth by both parties to say we have to be thoughtful about what we're doing. We can't bring thousands of people together in the midst of a pandemic. That would be irresponsible, and it would certainly not demonstrate any form of leadership that would build or generate voter trust.
And you think that got across to people then?
Well, I think for those people who watched it, I mean, the difficult part about these conventions, when you're really talking about them, is that the television format does lend itself to being one large infomercial, right? It's kind of a sales pitch to the public. And lacking drama, the public isn't necessarily so interested in watching it. So activists watch it, those who are committed partisans engage. But, you know, in its height, we're talking over those last couple weeks with first the Democrats and then the Republicans, you know, there were about 25 million people tuning in. That is a good night for politics. That is not a great night if you're comparing it to Super Bowl ratings or something else. So as a television event, these conventions have always been somewhat lackluster, at least in the modern era when the nominees have been largely uncontested or without the drama of the uncertainty about who would win the presidential nomination.
Laura Brown is the director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, and we're talking about the virtual aspect of the political conventions this year and whether even after the risk of COVID-19 subsides, if we should really stick with some of those strategies. We're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How much of the conventions did you watch? What did you like or dislike about the virtual setup? Did you think something was really effective or something really fell flat this year? Let's talk about it at 800-642-1234. Now, we heard from something from the Democratic National Convention. On the other hand, Republicans seem to highlight that the pandemic wasn't going to keep them from doing the work that needed to be done. Here's former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker.
Oftentimes, the media doesn't understand how Donald Trump and Mike Pence can be such a great team. But I had to tell you, they're a lot alike. Both are successful chief executives. Both are doers, not just talkers. And both have a deep and abiding love for America and for the American people. That's why both of them were in Wisconsin last week during the Democrats' convention while Joe Biden was hanging out in his basement in Delaware.
Laura, who do you think Walker was trying to appeal to there?
Well, certainly the Republicans were saying, look, we are doing things while the Democrats are having their convention. So if the Democrats are doing all of this virtual and everything is pre-taped, even if they've done a good job of bringing in people from all across the country with their videos and their comments, there is still the lack of kind of live activity engaged with it. Certainly, there wasn't much happening in Milwaukee. And so I think, you know, former Governor Scott Walker was trying to say, look, Republicans are on the move. They're really campaigning. They're really out there in a retail way. And some of this is obviously connecting in that there was a focus group that was done in Wisconsin whereby, you know, swing voters in Wisconsin did say that they felt as though the Biden campaign hadn't really connected with them or been concerned with them as much as they were with some other issues that were highlighted at the convention, namely issues related to systemic racism.
We're talking about the Republicans and the Democrats' virtual conventions, what worked and what didn't, whether we may see more of these in the future. Laura Brown is our guest. She's an associate professor and the director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. And there's a line for you. What do you think? 800-642-1234. Did you like the largely virtual conventions, or do you prefer the cheering crowds with funny hats and that live pomp and circumstance? Maybe you didn't tune in at all. Why? Why didn't you think that it was important to watch? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we are talking about this year's political conventions. The DNC and the RNC both held big parts of their conventions as virtual, in empty rooms or with pre-recorded elements. Some people thought that actually made for better events. Not everybody, though. Laura Brown is our guest. She's an associate professor and the director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. You can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Did you think this year's conventions were done well, or did they lack a little bit of excitement? What about the substance? You can give us a call at 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Laura, we talked about the fact that most Americans seem kind of uninterested in these conventions. If that's the case, why do we have them?
Well, we have to have them because the parties have a whole series of rules around what has to happen in order to win and earn the presidential nomination. So the roll call of the states, which the Democrats, I think, did exceedingly well during that convention, you know, where they had all of the videos of all of the different party chairs and delegates announcing the votes for Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, and those came to you from all across the country, and they were put together into a very compelling video. The Republicans tried to do some of that. Everyone was in Charlotte, and so many of the people essentially just gave a quick, you know, and this state is for President Trump. But what we did see, and what we do know, is that that has to happen. The parties have to vote on their nominees. They have to vote on the president, the vice president, and they also need to pass a platform. Now, the Republicans chose to essentially adopt the 2016 platform rather than pass a new one. But some of that is about what parties do. There's also, if I might add, just one other legal piece that I don't think most Americans realize. And that is when the presidential nominee officially accepts their party's nomination, that changes their status in the Federal Election Commission reporting from being a primary candidate to now a general election nominee. So all of the fundraising and the legal reporting also changes with that moment of the acceptance speech.
We are taking calls at 800-642-1234 while we talk with Laura Brown about the conventions this year. And we've got Kay from Altoona who's given us a call. Hi, Kay.
Hi. I did listen to parts of both conventions, and I really feel that the digital format is better than the face-to-face conventions because we focus more on what the speakers have to say rather than people bouncing around with signs and wearing goofy hats. And then I also feel kind of discouraged by other people that are commenting that it seems like it's all personal for them rather than thinking about what's best for the country. They feel like Joe Biden or Donald Trump was not paying enough attention to them. Well, that's never going to be the case. I don't know. I just think that people need to think of this more as a global perspective rather than personally. Do I personally resonate with that person? It doesn't matter.
Okay, thanks for that perspective. And Kay spent time watching those virtual conventions, says, hey, it was effective.
Well, I will say I thought it was effective too. And I really agree with her on the fact that the content of what was said became more important in a virtual format. I mean, you know, you can look at something like former First Lady Michelle Obama's speech. Had she given that speech live in person at an actual convention, what took her 17 minutes to deliver probably would have been an hour because it would have been interrupted by numerous applause and cheering. And while that does convey a sense of enthusiasm, some of what she said would have been lost because it would have been extended out and not come in kind of the condensed persuasive format of her just speaking face to face to the camera from her sofa. So I do think there are ways that these virtual conventions showed a different side of the parties than what is usually seen.
Thanks so much for the call, Kay. And we've got Carol in Menominee who wants to talk about the virtual conventions. Hi, Carol.
Hello. Yes, I agree with the previous caller. I much preferred this convention. I thought it made it real. This is a very, very serious business. It's not just a circus and a big party. And I really preferred it. And I especially liked the roll call, the virtual roll call by states. And I thought the Democrats did a very good job with that. They had real people, real citizens, giving their, just rooting for their state. And I really thought that was effective.
Oh, Carol, thank you so much for calling and helping us understand your perspective. And I know, Laura, you talked about how effective that roll call was. We're talking with Laura Brown, who's our guest. She's written multiple books, teaches at George Washington University. And we've got Jeff from Onalaska who wants to join the conversation, too. Hey, Jeff.
Hi there. I just thought that Biden really missed an opportunity to connect from Wisconsinites by not accepting the nomination from Milwaukee. I unfortunately think he kind of took up aid from Hillary Clinton, making assumptions on Wisconsinites that we have kind of our minds made up and we're going to swing back blue. And I didn't like the virtual format. I've had enough virtual. And I think both really the DNC missed an opportunity to connect with Wisconsin.
Jeff, thanks for that. Laura, what about that missed opportunity not being in Milwaukee?
Well, I do think it is a missed opportunity. I mean, I will tell you that I actually thought one of the more effective speeches was the speech when, vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris spoke, because what was interesting to me about her speech was that she was standing in a convention hall and there were all of these state signs behind her and it was empty. And it was almost another reinforcing message about how difficult life is in this pandemic. So I will tell you, I understand that need to connect with voters at the retail level and on the personal level. I think it probably would have been good for Vice President Biden to travel to Milwaukee and to have given his speech from an empty hall in Milwaukee. I do think that President Trump and Vice President Pence, they did do speeches with actual audiences. I don't know that that helped them, because I do think many of the pundits and most of the media commentary was talking about the fact that those people were not socially distanced, nor were they wearing masks. So I think there's a balance here. You know, how do you go there but convey the difficulty of the situation that we are all in as Americans?
Yeah. Laura, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Laura Brown is an associate professor and the director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. WPR and Wisconsin Watch are documenting the lives of Wisconsinites in this unprecedented time with a series called Outbreak Wisconsin. Children around the state are returning to school this week. Some districts have had to adapt to try to reduce the spread of COVID-19. In Eau Claire, Jessica Barrera had choices for her 10-year-old son, Nico. He could stay home and learn virtually full-time, or he could learn in person twice a week. But to make that choice, she had to balance what's best for Nico with her own health risks.
Today is August 26th. It's about 5:40 p.m. My name is Jessica Barrera, and I'm also with
Nico.
We're discussing the exciting going back to school next week. Are you excited, Nico?
No.
I think that would be the response any year from an 11-year-old. He actually did really well with the last few months of school and doing the virtual learning on the tablet. I do know that it would be tough being a kid, an 11-year-old kid, and having some of your friends right there in the class with you, but there's not a whole lot of interaction that can happen if you're 6 feet apart. And, you know, anyone that has kids knows that kids aren't going to just leave their masks on nicely. They're going to chew on them and probably lick their hands and try to touch other kids and say, you know, act like it's cooties and say they have coronavirus or whatever. And I personally have some higher risk health issues that even though kids seem to do fairly well, they say, if he was to bring it home, that could be dangerous. So yeah, we just decided to do all virtual for the first semester, and we'll go from there. So things are going to look a little different from regular school years.
Yes. Yes, they will.
Is that exciting, or is that...
No.
No?
Just now.
What do you think you're looking forward to the most?
Pizza lunches.
Pizza lunches? That may be the one benefit of doing virtual, right?
I can just flex on everyone at
You can
lunchtime.
Just have... You can.
Hey, check this out. I got a pepperoni pizza.
You can have pepperoni pizza every day.
Every day.
I think we're ready for next week, and we're going to see what it all looks like and have a schedule.
It's my birthday.
And next week is your birthday. Very, very true. A lot of exciting stuff going on next week. All right, so... From me and
Nico Barrera,
we're wishing all the families best of luck that are doing virtual, and even the ones that are half virtual and half in person. Things are going to be a lot different this year, but we'll get through it.
To hear more stories like this one, visit WPR.org/outbreakWisconsin. Coming up, we'll talk about some of the ideas the state's largest police group is suggesting to reform policing in Wisconsin. Join the conversation here on Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow morning on the Ideas Network, Wisconsin has no plans to publicize the names of schools with COVID-19 outbreaks. We're talking with a health and science reporter about pushback toward that plan and how different schools plan to handle notifications. Join us for the morning show from 6 until 9. Now, the state's largest police union is out with a new set of recommendations to reform law enforcement in Wisconsin. Yesterday, the Wisconsin Professional Police Association unveiled its blueprint for change. It calls for an expansion of body cameras, community policing, and criminal penalties for people who take part in what the association calls public violence and destruction. The proposals come 2 days after state Republicans convened a special session at the legislature to deal with a package of reform bills from Governor Evers. It lasted about 30 seconds with no action taken. Jim Palmer is the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Jim, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
Jim, where does this blueprint for change come from? Why is it happening now?
Well, I think, you know, as we've all seen following the tragic death of George Floyd in Minneapolis in May, you know, the topic of police reform in America and in Wisconsin has, you know, become elevated to a new place in our American consciousness like never before. And, you know, in the last week or so following the shooting of Jacob Blake in Kenosha, we've seen, you know, the national reckoning that surrounds policing has become even more intense and polarized. Following the death of George Floyd, you know, we decided as the state's largest law enforcement group that we really wanted to take advantage of the opportunity to be a leader. You know, Wisconsin, and in particular Wisconsin's law enforcement community, has been a pioneer in the area of police reform before. In 2014, as many people know, Wisconsin was the first state in the nation to mandate the independent investigations of officer-involved deaths by outside agencies. You know, our law enforcement community played an integral role in bringing that new law about. And so I think we can do that again, and we wanted to lead in a meaningful way.
You know, with those violent interactions between police and black men that you just cited, we know that the idea of police reform is an intense, a polarizing subject, and not much reform has been accomplished to this point. Your report says this dynamic is detrimental to everyone, including police officers. Explain that.
Well, I think we've seen just in the last week, you know, every time there is a controversial use of force incident anywhere in the country, and that includes Wisconsin, there is a lot of public discussion and healthy dialogue in many respects about what people view as, you know, areas that need to be changed. But as the attention, the media attention dissipates, so does any commitment to maintain that dialogue. And we didn't want to see that happen here. You know, as I mentioned earlier, you know, all these incidents are controversial. And this time in Kenosha, what makes it even more so and more unique is the fact that we have, as a backdrop, a presidential election. And that, I think, has really caused people to become even more polarized. And, you know, I think one of the messages that we wanted to send, and there are a couple with this overarching and comprehensive plan, is that, one, it is okay to support social change and the cause for social justice, and at the same time, support law enforcement in the incredibly difficult and dangerous jobs that they do. You know, far too often, it seems like we're becoming relegated into, you have to be in one camp or the other. And it doesn't have to be that way. And, you know, we fear that we're going to miss an opportunity as a state and as a society and as a country to have a reasonable dialogue, to come together and begin to make some, take some meaningful steps toward, you know, towards progress and towards making some changes that benefit not only the public, but the law enforcement officers that serve them.
I want to get to some of the recommendations you have, but you talked about how these incidents happen and then people stop talking about it and we don't do anything about it. Okay, well, who stops talking? Whose responsibility is this to keep the momentum up for reform?
Well, frankly, I think it's everybody's responsibility. And, you know, part of our the reason behind this undertaking in putting together this comprehensive plan was because we think, you know, we wanted to take responsibility as well. We just can't, you know, point fingers by any means. We have to make sure that we're doing our part and hope others see that call to action and want to join in. You know, following the death of George Floyd, we looked inward. We spent a lot of time evaluating ways and exploring ways to potentially strengthen the law enforcement profession. And then we also had a lot of candid, thoughtful discussions with Republican lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers, and others to make sure that what we were putting together made sense, would be good for law enforcement, good for the public, and that would represent changes that, you know, won't compromise officer safety and public safety, because certainly that's not something we want to do either. And so we feel very good about the plan that we put together, and we look forward to continuing to pursue these initiatives and others in the weeks and months ahead.
We're talking with Jim Palmer, who's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, and we are taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How hopeful are you that we'll manage to make the right reforms here in Wisconsin? Whose responsibility do you think police reform is? You can give us a call now at 800-642-1234 as we really dig into some of the recommendations in this proposal from the Police Association. Let's start with use of force. See this, there must be a problem with the way these policies are set up now, and how does this fix the issue of use of force?
Well, I think our policy with regard to use of force, I don't know that it necessarily starts from the premise that there's a problem. Hmm. There has been legislation introduced in the past that would require that certain principles be incorporated in every use of force policy in the state. As our document, a blueprint for change, explains, all those principles already exist in Wisconsin in one form or another. Some are in statute, some exist in the administrative code, and others exist in the law enforcement curriculum that governs training and education throughout the state. But we do think there is public policy value in codifying those and making sure that every agency policy across the state says those in one way. And I think that makes that's just good for uniformity purposes. And I think it sends a very clear and strong message to the public.
So you're saying that all these policies don't necessarily need to be changed, but we need to acknowledge them as standards across different departments?
What I'm saying is I think there's value in codifying these principles that already exist in one form or another, codifying them into a single statute. I think that that sends an important message not only to law enforcement officers, but to the public. So that I think there is, you know, there's some segments of the state and of the public that believe that, you know, these principles don't already exist. And they do. But I think we can shore them up by codifying them into one single statute.
Let's go ahead and take a call now. We've got Sam in Milwaukee ready to join our conversation. Sam, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me on. So I noticed that I think a Reuters poll after George Floyd was murdered showed that 96% of Americans agreed that we needed some form of policing reforms, including 94% of Republicans. And so, I mean, that's, you know, almost a 9/11 scale unity moment for the country. And then watching the Speaker of the House block a criminal justice reform bill at the national level was pretty shattering, I think, for a lot of people who expected our government to act. So as an organization like yours, how do you engage in both national level discussions and state level?
Yeah, Sam, you're breaking up, but we get it, with the police association having to work with different leaders. How do you get across what you think you need and also listen to lawmakers who are trying to create the laws, Jim?
Well, it is very challenging, especially in this highly partisan, polarized environment. You know, we try and play things straight, call them as we see them, and we think we have a very independent record when it comes to not only the legislation that we support, but you know, the candidates that we support when they run for office. You know, relative to state and federal issues, the legislation, the things that state lawmakers do are probably the things that will have the most impact on law enforcement in the state of Wisconsin. And so, you know, that's where our attention is focused. Assembly Speaker Robin Voss has created a task force that will be looking at a wide variety of police reform issues in the months ahead, leading up to the next session of the state legislature, and we look forward to playing an important part of that. And hopefully these policies will warrant some consideration. I'm sure there will be others. And I think as the state's largest law enforcement group, we have to maintain an open mind to those things and be willing to have a reasonable discussion with people from both sides of the aisle.
Is that sort of task force enough or fast enough? I mean, on this very program earlier this week, we had callers say, we've been talking about police reform. We know there are some things that are wrong and we should do them and stop studying them repeatedly. It's time to act. Is it time to act, Jim?
I think it is absolutely time to act. I think we do need to be thoughtful about it at the same time. I don't think, you know, I don't think we want to act hastily where, you know, issues of officer safety and public safety are concerned. Having said that, there have been quite a few proposals that have been around for the last few years. In fact, the report we put out, A Blueprint for Change, includes some of them from both Republicans and Democrats. So I just think we need to make sure we have I think the task force, to answer your question, can be an outstanding forum and an outlet for legislative recommendations that can be introduced early on in the next session of the legislature. We need to act, and we agree with that, and that's, you know, the other reason, fundamental reason why we came out with this report. Now is the time to act. I think the public demands it. I think law enforcement will benefit from it, and I think the public will benefit from it, but we do need to be thoughtful about it.
We're talking with the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, Jim Palmer. The group came out with a set of proposals to reform policing in Wisconsin. You can be part of this conversation at 800-642-1234. What kind of changes do you think need to happen to make policing more effective, better here in Wisconsin? 800-642-1234. Our conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. Right now, the state's largest police union is out with a new set of recommendations to reform law enforcement in Wisconsin. And we are talking with Jim Palmer, who's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. We're talking about the recommendations, and we're also taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Andrew from Eagle, who's ready to join the conversation. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good, thanks. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to ask the gentleman what his opinion was on getting away from the federal war on drugs and, decriminalizing the use of drugs by people in their homes, as long as they're not, you know, committing acts of violence on anybody or endangering anyone. What is his opinion on it? Because I think that it puts police officers in danger when they go to serve warrants on those houses, and it also puts the people inside the house in danger. And I was just curious what his thoughts were.
Andrew, thanks for that call. Jim Palmer, reducing some of the crimes that we have on the books now so that we decriminalize them and then police don't have to try to enforce them.
Well, I think, you know, in the past we've demonstrated and we've publicly stated that, some of the public policy pursuits of the last two decades have been, you know, perhaps tough on crime, but not necessarily smart on crime. Having said that, I think, you know, we've demonstrated a willingness to look at various proposals. But, I think those are issues that can be explored. I think there are a whole host of potential reforms in the criminal justice system, you know, just among others that we should be looking at. Relative to our plan, a blueprint for change, we really wanted to focus first internally and look at policing and public safety and come up with some proposals that we think will make a fundamental difference. I think that, you know, there are a whole host of areas that warrant some consideration. I'd have to, you know, look at any specific proposal relative to, you know, decriminalizing the use of certain drugs.
Although in your plan, one of the items would establish criminal penalties, in this case for people who intentionally participate in a riot. What's the thinking here?
Well, I mean, I think we've seen, I think there's a couple things I could say about this. You know, what, just first to take a step back, you know, law enforcement officers, I think, bristle, and rightfully so, anytime they see, especially public figures, paint them with a broad brush. There have been certain statements, frankly, by leaders at all levels, and most notably perhaps in Wisconsin, Governor Evers, that I think are not helpful to the kind of discourse that we need if we want to bring people together and affect meaningful change. I think the same is true relative to protesters. I think most people who have followed this closely recognize that the vast majority of the protests that have occurred in the last few months have been peaceful. However, there are people that have attempted to capitalize on those protest activities and engage in destructive and violent behavior. I think they, in part, have co-opted the peaceful protest message that might otherwise be sent. And I do think that there is value in exploring ways to hold people more accountable for when they engage in the kind of destructive behavior that we've seen in Madison, Kenosha, and other places around the country.
We've heard from some activists, some protesters who say they agree with you, and they say police could help de-escalate the situation more, too. Do you see a role for police to calm things down also?
Well, I think whether it's the police in Madison, Kenosha, or anywhere else in the country, you know, it is a delicate art form that no one has necessarily mastered in terms of what the right approach is, what the right tactics are, what the show of strength should be. You know, officers, first and foremost, they need to be able to protect the public. They need to protect themselves. And, I think these are very dynamic situations. And oftentimes officers are spread very thin, which is why we've seen, you know, National Guardsmen called in on a couple occasions throughout the state in the last few weeks. So I think there are things that law enforcement can do to de-escalate, but it is a delicate balance that's difficult to strike. And oftentimes it's worth noting, it's, you know, their action, law enforcement's actions are determined by the actions of those that they're encountering. You know, if people are throwing rocks and cans and things of that nature, whatever the case may be, I mean, officers should be entitled to take some enforcement action to protect themselves and others. So I think it is a constant and dynamic area of policing. And I know that it's something that every agency, when they're confronted with these types of situations, looks at very, very, very carefully.
Is that a one-way street, or do you see it the other way, too, that if police are firing things on protesters, that protesters may reasonably try to fight back?
It can work both ways, I suppose. I mean, like I said, it is a delicate balance. And I don't know that anyone anywhere in the country, frankly, has mastered what that should be. We've seen some places throughout the country where law enforcement's just pulled back completely. And there have been, you know, pretty significant spikes in crime in those areas as a result. So I do think it's a delicate balance. And I know that's something that law enforcement agencies constantly evaluate when these protest events take place.
We've got Jim Palmer, who's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, here with us. And we've got Louie from Phillips, who wants to talk here. Hi, Louie.
Hey. Yeah, I just hear a lot here lately about the police reform. And I just, you know, like, with these poor guys, they're really under the gun. And you know, to tell you the truth, I've been on the other end of the police baton. When I was a younger man, I was quite the rascal, disorderly conduct and resisting arrest and all that and good stuff. And what I've learned was that these guys never singled me out just for laughs. Anytime we had a run-in or a bumping with each other, it was because I did something to get their attention. And then I also found out that if I didn't give them a hard time, it would be a lot easier on everybody because I'd say, you're not taking me to jail. And, well, I was going to go to jail whether I wanted to go or not. It might take 5 or 6 months, but eventually I went to go into jail with some lumps on me and extra charges. And luckily I never got shot. But I'm looking at it a different light now, especially after 9/11, when you see everyone running away from those buildings and the policemen running into those buildings. It gave me a different perspective on those guys and what they have.
Yeah, Louie, and Louie, thank you for sharing that story. And I also hear Louie saying people need to follow police orders. And to do that, police have to trust people and people have to trust police. Are you making any recommendations to try to improve those relationships between people in the community and police as they encounter one another?
Oh, I think there are quite a few. It's hard to just, frankly, just pick one. We have a lot of oversight and accountability measures. To Louie's point, I do think it should not be lost that there is an individual issue, an issue of individual responsibility that is at play here as well. When law enforcement officers, issue orders, people should absolutely follow them. Now, if an individual doesn't, that doesn't necessarily entitle a particular use of force by an officer. So I don't want to say issue the common law enforcement response that you see from other, in other places around the country that, well, if a person just would have done what they were told, it wouldn't have happened. But at the same time, I do think, we shouldn't completely neglect that there is some amount of individual responsibility that people have when they're in their interactions with police as well. We think a lot of the provisions and proposals that we've come up with will help strengthen the relationship between law enforcement and the communities they serve. Not only in we have provisions and proposals, rather, that add more accountability measures, add transparency in the hiring process. And we think there are a lot of good things that will we strongly support body-worn cameras. And we think that's one of the most important things in here. I think there's no one proposal that will do all the, is going to fix the situation necessarily. I think it's going to be it's going to be a combination of things. It has to be a collaborative effort. And hopefully, our putting out this report yesterday, A Blueprint for Change, will help represent a positive foot forward in that regard.
Yeah, Jim, I know we were only able to talk about a few of those proposals. There are a lot of them. We'll make that is posted online at WPR.org/Central Time so people can check it out. And we really appreciate your time going through a couple of those proposals and also talking about this more broadly.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity, and I hope to be talking to you again about some of the progress that we need to make.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Jim Palmer is the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. And we talked with him about police reforms his group unveiled this week, known as the Blueprint for Change. Again, that's posted at WPR.org/Central Time. And here on the Ideas Network, we have made some changes to keep you informed and connected. You'll find both 1A and On Point at new times, plus a few new shows and some other changes. Take a listen. Let us know what you think. You can find complete details on our website at WPR.org/fall2020. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we talk about the challenges of the upcoming flu season, especially here in Wisconsin amid COVID-19. I'm Keeley Boltina. This is the Ideas Network, and you're listening to Central Time.
Thank you to the donors who make Wisconsin Public Radio possible. There are more than 50,000 of you. Your generosity delivers essential news, thought-provoking conversations, and inspiring music to listeners all over Wisconsin and beyond. Your support makes a difference in people's lives every day. Thank you.